This is a WBUR.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, David Brooks, says he practices comic sociology, which is altogether too modest because it's what the best of them, like John Kenneth Galbraith and Thorsten Veblen, have done of old. David Brooks is a newspaper correspondent who had to leave the U.S. for years and return to see what had changed. It was a lot of little things. The stockbrokers who found they liked living in artists' lofts downtown, and the art professors who were dabbling in the stock market. It was the emblematic success stories of companies like Nantucket Nectars and Ben & Jerry's, militantly mindful, socially and environmentally hip hits, in which consciousness raising met and married cost control. It was the triumph of certain people in a new elite. Doris Kearns Goodwin, Skip Gates, Ken Burns, Stephen Jay Gould, Maureen Dowd, Steve Jobs, Jerry Seinfeld, Tina Brown, people who suggested that a certain memory of 60s rebellion had melted with respect for 80s achievement to break down an old barrier and create a new paradise for a new species. The new person at the top of the heap is the Bobo, with bourgeois sense and bohemian sensibility, a person who grew up questioning authority and now finds he is one. Connection Bobos, are you an anti-materialistic soul who has to admit now that you're rich by any standard? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Are you an anti-elitist in the new elite? Don't despair. You're probably not all bad. David Brooks is a Bobo, and he thinks Bobos are going to rule the roost for a long time. Make the Bobo connection at 1-800-423-TALK. And welcome, finally, David Brooks in person in our studio. We've talked to you many times with great pleasure. And we love this idea of the Bobo. Beau for bourgeois, beau for bohemian. Recall, for people who just landed, what the old conflict was.
Well, it was a conflict between the bourgeois and the bohemian. The bourgeois, they were the merchants, the shopkeepers. They had the Benjamin Franklin virtues, moderation, industry, temperance, fidelity, and faith. The classic bourgeois institutions were things like family, organized religion, the military, the marketplace. And the people who hated the bourgeois, hated the middle classes, were bohemians. And it really started in Paris in the 1830s. And they looked at the bohemians and they decided they were vapid. They were ruled by these narrow commercial values that didn't allow them to be spiritual. Flaubert said he hated the stupid grocers and their ilk. They were plodding and avaricious. Stendhal said hatred of the bourgeoisie is the beginning of all virtue. And really, for 150 years, you could tell who was bourgeois from who was bohemian. If you liked Ike in the 50s, you were bourgeois. If you liked the Beats, you were bohemian. If you read Horatio Alger stories 100 years ago, you were bourgeois. If you were in Greenwich Village talking about revolution, you were bohemian. And we had this real culture war. The bourgeois were materialists. The bohemian were anti-materialists. The bourgeois were polite. The bohemian were raw. The bourgeois were career-oriented. And the bohemian were experience-oriented. The bourgeois pretended to be chaste, and the bohemians pretended to be promiscuous. But now you go into these coffee shops, and you can't tell an espresso-sipping banker from a cappuccino-drinking artist. You've got, even in commercial banking circles, you've got these guys wearing these teeny tiny steel-framed glasses that, you know, that give you the peripheral vision of a worm, because even in banking circles, it's cool to look like Franz Kafka instead of Johnny Carson all of a sudden.
And you've got Dalai Lama in an Apple computer ad. I always wondered about that one. Or Jack Kerouac as a sort of commercial symbol. Or James Dean.
He's in the Gap. You've got all these companies. Lucent Technology uses the phrase born to be wild. A Burger King, you know, you don't exactly think of Burger King as the classic countercultural institution, but their slogan is sometimes you got to break the rules. And it's funny, it's in corporate America where the countercultural ethos has merged with the bourgeois ethos. You know, you talk to businessmen now, and they want to sound like they're 16-year-old joystick jockeys. You say, how'd the IPO go? And they go, oh, it cratered. You know, how's the product pipeline? Oh, it's insanely great. You know, how was the sales meeting? Oh, it was a mind meld. And it's the classic case of sort of 60s values merging into the heart of what was the bourgeois world, corporate America, transforming the culture and creating this synthesis between the two, which really now is the atmosphere we all breathe.
I had forgotten that line, if I ever knew it, that Stendhal saying, hatred of the bourgeois is the beginning of all virtue.
Yeah, Flaubert signed his letters bourgeoisophobus, because he wanted to show how much he hated the bourgeois.
Bougie.
Right.
It's a terrible name to put on anybody, but the point is that there was real contempt there.
Yeah, and
I mean,
you could
deep
tell,
contempt.
You could tell who was who, and people identified themselves. I'm on this side, I'm on that side. I'm commercial, I'm anti-commercial. But now we're all sort of commercial, and we're all sort of rebels. We're artists in our own corporations.
Or are we? I mean, can you find the heart of the bourgeois at the bottom of everything, or even the heart of a bohemian?
Yeah, well, you look at yourself and you look at some of these people, you know, you got bankers in a coffee shop.
They're still bankers.
Yeah, you say, well, who sold out to who? And
right.
It's
or
a
who
question.
Co-opted what?
Right, and it's a question you really can't answer easily. But I think at the end of the day, the bourgeois won. Because while they now, you know, they have their distressed furniture on the grounds that if your furniture is distressed, your conscience doesn't have to be. And they stylistically, all these bohemian patterns, you've got financial people, you know, with Peruvian fabrics and sort of the peasant dresses. But on the bottom of the day, you had the bohemians, the people who were the critics of capitalism. They now love capitalism. They accept the order of capitalism as long as they can wear black T-shirts to work. And they accept the values of the marketplace. I think there's never been a time in 100 years where capitalism had as much prestige as it does now, never a time when there were fewer mortal enemies of capitalism. And once you make that transition, all sorts of other things fall into place, among them a love of stability and order. You know, the bourgeois always believed in liberation, emancipating themselves from the old order and really going into a world of total freedom. But now if you look at society, it's a world where people want to reassert community control, want to believe in civility and order and stability. You know, there's a book coming up by Robert Putnam, the Harvard sociologist, called Bowling Alone. Can you imagine a bohemian or any intellectual in the 60s using bowling leagues as his symbol of good community? They were considered the height of bourgeois flatulence. But now we're living in a culture where the politics is tepid and order-oriented, not radical, where the culture is interested in preserving community and authority. So I think at the end of the day, in a political sense and in a religious sense, the bourgeois have won, even if in the commercial sense, the bohemians seem to have won on the surface.
This is fascinating. I mean, you say capitalism won, and I guess you have to say that's right. In another way, education won, or brains won. Part of the whole thing about capitalism, we don't associate capitalism with sort of railroads or heavy industry or simple ideas or single J.P. Morgan kind of bottom lines. It's you have to be smart now to be in business. You have to be very, very smart. You have to be culturally hip. You have to be young, competitive, edgy, original. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
As you write in the book, the educated class has conquered all. It's bought into a lot of the capitalistic idea, but it's also asserted a great deal of itself.
Yeah, one of the things I describe in the book, I start with a description of the New York Times wedding page, which is a great way to look at the American elite because it's very selective. In the 1950s, the wedding page didn't tell you what jobs the people had. They told you what boat or what year the ancestors came over, 1687 or 1727. They talked about the prep schools and the men's clubs the men went to, the cotillion balls the brides came out of. It was the Protestant establishment. Now, if you look at the Times wedding page, it's like the mergers and acquisitions page. It's a clash of resumes. Harvard marries Yale. Princeton marries Stanford. It's, you see magna cum laude marrying another magna cum laude. You never see a magna marrying a summa because, you know, the conflicts would be too great in such a wedding. But really, it's the rise of this educated class. And that is a product of the information age. And it's the information age that has created this synthesis culture. It's not just because bankers suddenly decided I'm going to spend $5 for a loaf of fancy spinach feta bread. But what happened was we have a new economy. And the essence of the information age is that ideas and creativity are as important as finance, capital, and natural resources to succeed. And therefore, the people who thrive in this era can turn ideas and emotions and turn them into products. So they have one foot in the bourgeois world of products and another foot in the bohemian world of creativity. And it's that tremendous openness. If you were an artist or a university person in the 60s and 70s, suddenly the information age kicked in and wealth was open to you. You could go to Silicon Valley, you could design a web page, you could do all sorts of things which really would allow you to express yourself creatively and sell it. And it's that that really created this synthesis.
It's an age of selling, of course, also an age of reconciliation in slogans that make you think twice and sometimes keep thinking. Compassionate conservatism, as you said. Smart growth. Prosperity with a purpose. Practical idealism. Sustainable development. Take any one of those slogans, and which one is a cover for the other? Which one's the fake? Compassionate conservatism. I think we know which one's the fake there. Practical idealism. Is there any such thing? Can these things be reconciled?
Yeah, I think if you fudge enough and if you get shallow enough, you can reconcile anything. My favorite of those is a phrase I came across while researching in Montana. A rabbi there described his service as flexidoxy. Now, what he meant was he takes the bohemian urge to be self-creating, to have your own religion that you yourself have engineered, be flexible and free. And then he marries that to the bourgeois orientation toward orthodoxy, to defer to authority and to follow the rigid rules. And he sort of mushes it all together. So he's trying to create a religion which is half ritual and authority to give yourself comfort, but also freedom and self-expression. And he tries to jam it all in. And I think that's a perfect description, that phrase flexidoxy, for Bobo spirituality, which is sort of half freedom, sort of a house of obligation built on a foundation of choice. And it's the perfect way Bobos try to reconcile these two.
Sustainable development, and there's environmental prosperity, growth, and greenery. Where do you start hacking that apart?
Well, I think sustainable development, sometimes I think in the material world especially, it can work. I think you can actually have sustainable development. You can reach the sort of compromises that doesn't worship growth above all else, that really does try to control it. And if you look at upscale culture, upscale suburbs today in particular, one of the things you notice about them is these tremendous efforts to control growth. And those are real, and I think on the whole successful. And that's one way sort of the rapacious developer has been enlightened by the bohemian influx into the business world.
David Brooks is our guest. His book is called Bobos in Paradise, Bobo being a contraction of bourgeois and bohemian. It's the meld that defines the elite of our time and for a long time to come, he says. 1-800-423-8255. Self-approving or self-hating Bobos, call in. 1-800-423-TALK. Valerie is on a car phone.
Hi, Christopher.
The medium of the Bobo is the car phone. Valerie,
right.
Welcome.
I couldn't afford a car phone until a month ago.
Did you get rich or they get cheap?
I got rich.
How'd it go?
Yeah. A working class girl from Cambridge who lived in the Cambridge of old can now afford to live in the Cambridge of new. And I can't figure out what to do about it.
Which part of it hurts?
The part that hurts? Not seeing very many familiar faces. And really liking the new faces. That hurts.
You know, you
it's a
say,
nice problem to have. Though.
Yeah, you say working class Cambridge, and there was such a thing once upon a time.
There really was.
Have working class identities and those lines and the fashionability of even thinking about them disappeared in Bobo land?
Well, I'm really new to Bobo land, but they haven't disappeared in me. But I don't meet many of me in my current circles. Mm-hmm. I don't meet any of me in my current circles.
How did you make your money?
My Sorry? Husband works for an internet company, stock options.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a stay-at-home mom.
Okay. Talk about the conflict here.
Okay. Well, I've always been very pro public school. I've always been, I was actually raised to be almost afraid of people with wealth or high educations or any of that elite. And I was also raised you can't help but be raised in Cambridge to grow up and appreciate the bohemian and the, gosh, I had a really great phrase for it at one time, but just knowing that you were superior because you didn't have any money.
Mm.
And knowing that you were superior because you, you know, you took care of your family, you go visit your grandmother, you know, all those sorts of things, and that you have to work really hard to get a car. And just a few months ago, I paid cash for a brand new car. It's just really conflicting. And I wanted to send my kids to public schools. I wanted to make sure they were in a very diverse classroom. And now I'm thinking, well, you know, gee, maybe we could send them to private schools, and they could have the best education that money can buy, and they could go on to any school of their choice. And maybe I'm keeping them down. It's a real conflict for me on how to raise my kids.
It's funny. This is what I call in the book the anxieties of affluence.
Yeah.
People who are sort of disturbed by the widening gap between the rich and poor, but suddenly find themselves on the rich side of that gap. And the phrase that you used that struck out at me was, you were superior because you didn't have any money. And one of the things I noticed in doing the research was that people have devised ways of spending money that sort of show that they're still against money. That are supposed to show to the world that they haven't become one of the stuck-up rich people. For example, they spend lots of money on things that used to be cheap, like, you know, $3 for a cup of coffee, $5 for a loaf of bread. They buy one of these fancy Cognoscenti lettuces that taste so bad on sandwiches. And part of that is a way to show, you know, they buy upscale versions of proletarian things. It's a way to sort of be pretentious and populist at the same time. And I think it's a way people do not want to be like the old elite, the old Protestant establishment. They don't want to be snobs. They don't want to be racist or anti-Semitic. But they want to pioneer a new way to be affluent in a way that shows they haven't sold out and lost their soul. And this is one of the creative things that leads to all these companies doing these silly things, that leads to the Restoration Hardwares, that leads to the Bread and Circuses or the Fresh Field grocery stores.
I'm parked outside Bread and Circus right now.
What I love about those places is, you know, you can get your basmati rice and your vegetarian dog biscuits. And I saw in there once all natural hair dye, as if you're going to artificially dye your hair. Why do you care if it's all natural? But, you know, they've taken the things that were fun in the 60s, like free love and nudity, and they've gotten rid of that. But they've kept all the things that are of interest to middle-aged hypochondriacs, like whole grains and stuff. But that sort of is a suburban hippiedom, Bread and Circus. And that is the culture exactly that you get in the information age.
Valerie, how do you and your husband enjoy spending money? I mean,
well, it is, it's pretty new, but now we can just plan a vacation because we want to, when we want to. We bought a new car for cash. We just built a jacuzzi with a steam unit. It's pretty cool, that part.
Enjoy it, Valerie.
And we give money away. I want to make sure we let that known.
Who do you give it to?
Gave a lot to, my son's grammar school and also Families First. They do parenting education in Cambridge and here and there and family. Keeping my family afloat.
Valerie, there should be a picture of you on the cover of David Brooks's book. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Bobo connection. Ron is on the line.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning, Ron.
Until this morning, I didn't realize, at least in terms of phrasing, that I was an aspiring Bobo.
Uh-huh. This afternoon you may be the real thing.
Well, I hardly doubt it based on my particular career choice. I'm sort of a private practice public interest lawyer, and that, you know, that I think sums up the Bobo, but I think the emphasis is definitely on bourgeois rather, I mean on bohemian rather than bourgeois. At least in terms of getting clients to pay.
That's great. Well, there's a perfect reconciliation, public interest, private practice lawyer.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you have to be rich to be a Bobo, but you have to be torn between the system and the establishment and being a competitive person who wants to succeed in the world and at the same time wanting to be a little countercultural, not wanting to be mainstream.
Right, and what I found in my own experience, I've been out of law school for about 7 years, is that I definitely went from bohemian to bourgeois once I got a wife and a kid and a house. Now, you know, with the student loans still hanging over me like a dark cloud and, you know, a child's future to plan for, I have to be more aware of that, you know, that ugly pragmatic aspect of life, which is saving and earning.
Yeah, one of the things that Valerie mentioned that also strikes me is how deep the bourgeois mentality goes into us. You know, a lot of people in universities especially were rebels of some sort, but they were also meritocrats. They were also rising in the world, and they had the idea that everything they do should be about their own self-growth and self-development. And I actually survey sort of high-toned sex journals in the book, sort of the people leading moral sex, and you don't just have sex, you achieve orgasm. They're always wanting to get better and better at everything. There are always training manuals about everything. Even vacations, you can't just go lie on the beach, you have to take an eco-tour, which is good for your soul, or you have to go to Myanmar and Minsk and or climb the Himalayas, because everything has to be good for you. And that is a sort of utilitarian code that both the bourgeois and the bohemian would sort of applaud, because it's all about self-definition and self-improvement. You know, you're struck when you go to the park and you see people running around scantily clad. And on the one hand, if the Puritans came back and saw women running around in sports bras, they'd be horrified. You know, nudity, you know, civilization is coming to an end. But then they'd look at the faces, and the faces are looks of grim determination, of people working out, of people improving. And in some way, that is the Protestant ethic brought to modern
times. Yeah, and we mentioned, I mean, the drink of the bobo is coffee, after all.
Right, and not booze.
And if there's any booze at all, it's white wine. But the point is to be acute at all times, a little more intense than Mother Nature designed you.
Because it's an elite based on brain power, not blood, so the country club people could drink, and that's how they built their bonds, getting drunk together. But this is an elite where being articulate is very important, and being educated is very important. You know, I don't know if you remember, there was a game called Match Game 74, where people would have to guess an answer, and a celebrity panel would have to, they'd have to fill in a phrase, and you'd have to match the phrase. And the phrase this person had to match was half. And he said half drunk. And four out of the six panelists, celebrity panelists, said half drunk. Today, if you ask that question, it would be like half and half or something like that. But booze really soaked our culture for a long time. And now when, you know, the so-called free spirits and the pleasure-loving 60s people come, now it's coffee and it's, you know, everything's health-oriented and safety-oriented.
1-800-423-8255, the Bobo connection, bourgeois bohemianism and other contradictions of the new ruling class. 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection with David Brooks. Patrick is on a car phone.
Hey, Christopher. Good morning.
Welcome, Patrick.
I wanted to ask your guest if he had heard of a magazine called The Baffler out of Chicago. They have a very different take on the same subject of the Bobo. It's a very critical take on it. They have chapter titles like Why Johnny Can't Dissent and The Interns Built the Pyramids. And it's talking about very much the same thing, how dissent has been commodified. Now, the bankers are in Starbucks with their wire-rimmed glasses on, but they're still bankers.
Right.
I wonder if he had heard of this.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The Baffler is a very good magazine from a much further left perspective than I'm from. And their basic take is that what I call the reconciliation between the bourgeois and bohemian, their take, it's just the sellout of the bohemians. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. I have a chapter on intellectual life, and I talk about the way intellectuals who used to be really apart from society commenting upon it in a realm of bohemian, almost like a secular priesthood, how they have now become intellectual entrepreneurs. And I have this sort of jokey chapter on how to be Henry Kissinger if you start out, how to manipulate the TV media, how to publish your book, The End of Ideology, or The End of This, or The End of That, how to get press, how to behave at conferences to enhance your status. But I think what I'm trying to get out there is that the dissenters of mainstream life have become entrepreneurs and have become co-opted by commercial culture. But where I differ from the Baffler is they say it's just a sellout. But if you look at corporations today, it's not just that they talk funny or they use these funny slogans. But if you take the critique that the new left had of corporate America and of bureaucracies, there were big arguments against technocracy, against rigid bureaucracies, against the organization man. And that critique, that again, they were in favor of sort of personalistic face-to-face relationships. They were in favor of personal creativity. That critique has been absorbed by corporations. So the New Left critique in the 60s is now conventional wisdom in management circles today. And so they haven't just sold out. They've reshaped American corporations, and it's been tremendous. You know, in the early 70s, a guy named Daniel Bell wrote a book called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. He said, on the one hand, you've got this bourgeois ethos that's for productivity and working hard. On the other hand, there's this bohemian ethos, which is all about pleasure and not working. And he said this pleasure-oriented ethos is going to undermine the bourgeois ethos and tear down our economy. But the exact opposite has happened. These countercultural people came in with their ideas about creativity, and they've transformed the corporations, really transformed them, and they find they work harder. If you think your job is not just a way to earn a living, but as part of your artistic self-expression, you'll work 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day. You go into these high-tech workplaces, they've got their sleeping bags under the desks because they spend all night there. I ran into an advertising guy named Lee Clow, who said, you know, he was asked, how come people come in on weekends? And on Wall Street, the joke used to be, if you don't come in on Saturday, don't bother coming in on Sunday. I mean, you had to work, you had to work that long. But now everyone's there 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And he said, well, this is a creative place, and people just love to come to this big sandbox. And he used that phrase, this big sandbox. So it's play. It's not a sweatshop. It's a sandbox. And people are working extremely hard, and they have transformed these places. So that's where I differ from the Baffler, which thinks they've just sold out to them.
When we come back after the break, I want to talk about what's missing in this world of the Bobos. I mean, and I think it's what Patrick was talking about. There are no happily isolated, lonely, small circulation intellectuals anymore. You got to be on television. You got to have, as you say, a market niche. But an intellectual with a market niche is a contradiction in terms. There's also no anger. There's nothing like that kind of cleansing contempt that you say Stendhal expressed for the bourgeoisie. There's also no class energy in the newspapers anymore. The newspapers always used to have a kind of working class voice and anger. That too is gone, and a certain realism with it. We'll be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Bobo Connection. Bobo being David Brooks's term for the merger of bourgeois and bohemian mores, values in a new elite that dresses bohemian and knows the bottom line. 1-800-423-8255 joins the Bobo conversation. Patrick was raising this question out of the Baffler, sort of, why can't Johnny dissent? Why can't we have clear lines, even in our politics? We have George Bush talking about compassionate conservatism, Al Gore talking about sustainable development. This age of reconciliation blurs all of the good old lines of natural combat. Where is the outrage? Where is the potential for, where's the possibility for just getting clear here and old, tough-minded ways?
There's very little of it. You know, you had these people who started out outraged at the way the world works, and then they decide to buy one of these, renovate their kitchen so it's the size of an aircraft hangar with plumbing, you know, with a big stove. And they said, this is pretty nice. And then they said, well, I've still got a social conscience. So, you know, they buy one of these high-class toothpaste, the kind, you know, socially enlightened. It doesn't kill germs. It just asks them to leave. So, you know, our social conscience is now expressed by our consumption. But, you know, one of the reasons I think the bourgeois has ultimately won the culture war is the bourgeois always loved order. They love stability. They hate vehemence and conflict. And now we are in a political age where people dislike vehemence. They dislike ideologies of left or right. So whether it's Hillary Clinton wanting to have sort of a new sort of healthcare system, they don't want that kind of radical change. Or whether it's Newt Gingrich on the right wanting to have scale back government, they don't want that kind of change. They want a very modest conservative in the old fashioned sense, disliking change, disliking anything that seems vehement or radical. And it's funny, it used to be the left wing that attacked the bourgeois for being conformist, for being sunk in their own fat. But now conservatives are beginning to do it. And it's very interesting because conservatives were always on the side of the businessman. But during the Clinton-Lewinsky thing, for example, conservatives were saying, why isn't middle America rising up? This man's an outrage against morality. Bill Bennett wrote a book called The Death of Outrage.
Right. Where's the outrage?
And so, but there
what
is
What could
none.
Shake it up? I mean, this is a country that has benefited, should we say, very disproportionately from this new prosperity. What about the other 85%? Why won't we hear from them one of these days with a big wake-up call about social reality?
I went into this book thinking it would come, thinking, you know, first of all, you've got widening inequality of income inequality. Secondly, and even more importantly, social inequality. You know, you go into a Restoration Hardware, you go into a Crate and Barrel, it's not only the prices are reasonably high, but the sensibility is high. You walk in there, and if you don't get, have the cultural capital to get all the ironic references and all that, you would feel alienated. So I thought, well, the rest of the people who don't have fancy college degrees or any college degrees are going to get fed up with these people. Who are they to think they can spend all this money and still be consider themselves virtuous when they're really everything somehow always benefits them? But then as I researched the book, I have to say the ground is there, but I didn't find the social resentment. What I found instead was middle class and lower middle class America adopting everything. And I was out in the middle of Montana at a truck stop, and there was a cappuccino stand there. Not only was there a cappuccino stand there, it was 6 feet off the ground, so the truckers didn't have to get out of their cabs to get their espressos. They could just stick their arm out and pull in their espressos. And I found that over and over again. You'd go to a downscale mall, and suddenly somebody would be selling, you know, one of these new age CDs, Wolf Solitudes, you know, that really are sort of baudelarized from the environmental movements or the new age movement. Everything sort of bleaches down, and I really found no great social differences between people in the middle class and people in this elite bobo culture.
One of the things I like about your book, David Brooks, is that you're very, you name the names. You say, for example, you can feel the bobo ethos in the old institutions that have been taken over by the new establishment, such as the New Yorker, Yale University, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, which now includes people like Toni Morrison, Jules Feiffer, and Kurt Vonnegut, or the New York Times, which now runs editorials entitled In Praise of the Counterculture. You can sense the ethos with special force in the new establishment institutions that would have been alien to the old elite, like NPR, DreamWorks, Microsoft, AOL, Starbucks, Yahoo, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and Borders. Decode all that. What are you driving at?
Well, I mean, NPR, let's start where we're sitting. It's an interesting example because it doesn't, you know, it's a major news source for millions of people in this country. But if you looked at Henry Luce, you don't think of, and the old Protestant establishment, very straight-laced, very imposing. The people at NPR, and I now know a fair number, are not of that sort. They come from a different tradition, much more casual, much more buttoned down, much more conversational. So a lot of that, the old imposing authority of the formal establishment has been replaced by something much more casual, much more countercultural, and yet at the same time, it is a major institution. And it's, I think it's true of DreamWorks. You know, if you, when they pose the people at DreamWorks in these business magazine profiles, they've always got a wacky accoutrement to show how wild and crazy they are. They've got, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg will have his super soaker water cannon. Somebody will show they have a bungee cord or, you know, a snowboard with a Schiller quotation on it. And that's to show we may be rapacious businessmen, but we're also wacky creative types as well. And that is typical of the bobo culture.
1-800-423-8255 makes the bobo connection with David Brooks. John is on a car phone.
Yes, hi. I think a lot of what I was going to say was already said by Patrick, I think. But I do have to agree that there is, in my view, it is more of a sellout than a melding, in that all of this talk about bohemianism and the slogans that you mentioned, there's nothing substantive to it, in that the power structure of the country hasn't changed. If anything, corporations have much more power than they did previously. When you talk about the actual internal changes of corporation structure and management, I think that's just a necessity for them to increase their bottom line. It's not out of any higher motives that's done. That's because they need to retain certain talent, so they have to cater to certain types of people.
I guess I would say there are different things that have happened. And one of the big changes is where the elite are drawn from. In the 1950s with the Protestant establishment, what mattered is who you were born to, whether you were of the right ethnic group, whether your father or grandfather were in the right firm. And it really was blood-based elite. Now it's a university-based elite. One of the interesting things happened at Harvard University. 1950, the average SAT of a Harvard incoming freshman was 580, which was good but not great. The vast majority of the people who applied were admitted, and they applied because they were the sons and the grandsons of the right sort of people. By 1960, the average SAT was 680. The average freshman from 1950 would have placed in the bottom 10% of the class of 1960, and that's because a revolution had taken place. What had happened was Harvard had decided that we are no longer going to be the finishing school of the upper-class Protestant establishment. We're going to branch out, and we're going to admit more and more people from around the country who happen to be smart, whether they're Jewish or black or any other ethnic group. And that happened across the Ivy League, and so you had one meritocratic elite displacing another. And it had several effects. One, the old Protestant establishment ethos was destroyed, and that was not entirely a good thing, though it was largely a good thing. But the other, you had a new elite that was based on university values rather than country club values. And that was the meritocracy. And in some ways, what I'm writing about is what sort of country do you get when you get a meritocracy? And one of the things you get is an elite that's very good at propagating itself. Marx said the elites that are most dangerous are the ones that absorb the rising men of the opposition classes. And this elite is best in history at absorbing the rising men and women of the opposition, or of what could be the opposition. Because if you are smart, they say, you've got a good idea, come to our college, come to our workplace, and join us. And they co-opt everybody, and you just get the money. And one of the things that's happened to our politics is that the people on the left and right are driven crazy by the Gore, the Bush, the Clinton. These people are ideological mushes, but they never fight back. They never mount a coherent defense of themselves because they have one idea from the left, one idea from the right. They have no ideology. They just co-opt, absorb, they destroy conflict. There's no argument. That you can't have an argument against a Gore or a Bush. And it's really very frustrating for the left and the right. They just follow the advice on the throw pillows that living well is the best revenge, and these synthesis third way middle ideologically mushy people just keep going. And if you look around politically across the Northern Hemisphere, this third way approach, which is a reconciliation of the old bourgeois and the old bohemian, it just dominates the globe.
1-800-423-8255. Bobos in Paradise is David Brooks's new book about the new upper class and how they got there. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Terry is on the line.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling, Terry.
I have to say that according to David's description, myself, my husband, my family do qualify as Bobos.
Bobi.
Bobi. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Bobo women, or the women in the Bobo movement. What I see in my neighborhood here, we live in a upscale enclave, and what I find is that my neighbors are women who have degrees, advanced degrees, JDs. Several of them have been admitted but turned down medical school. And what I find is that these women, for one reason or another, we are the group of women who fought for feminism, burned our bras, wore no makeup, etc. in college, and now that in our 20s, many of us may have started our own companies, sold the companies. Very successful women have now turned away their six-plus-figure incomes to become stay-at-home moms, and it's really an interesting phenomenon, I think, because what's happened is, for example, in our school system here, we do have an embarrassment of riches because we even have a hard time convincing the town to increase the taxes because the moms have done such a good job. There was an article in the local paper that we've actually, through our little fundraising efforts, we've earned $250,000 for the grade schools. And you have women Bobos bringing all this. And David was talking about where is the charity, that type of thing. I have to say that I do think, what I do see is that I think that the people I know do talk a lot about charitable contributions, but they do also pad their own nest, so to speak. You know, our school system, we do not spend that much per student as compared to the other towns, but there's a tremendous amount of this type of thing, successful fundraising, for example, going on. And I just was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that, because I find that an incredible phenomenon that, you know, in my children's preschool, we have this list of extremely successful women, some of whom are working from the home because their husbands are engaged in things like...
Terry, let me ask David Brooks, do-gooding impulses go here?
Well, first let me start with the kids, because I think that really is a great change in everyone's life, including my own, and it has a great bourgeoisifying effect when you've got kids. And the great change is the way we raise our children. You know, my kids in elementary school, and we arrange play dates, and arranging a play date is like doing the merger of Time and Warner. It's this incredibly complicated thing. Will the kids be allowed to play on the computer? Will they watch TV? Will it be a nanny-to-nanny play date, mommy-to-nanny, daddy-to-mommy, daddy-to-nanny? There's all this permutations that go along with raising kids. And one of the things I've noticed is that many of the people who grew up thinking, well, kids really should be free to develop on their own, now supervise their kids to an incredible degree. And now everything about childhood has to be edifying and developmental. You know, there are all these toy stores that pretend to be educational institutions like Zany Brainy and Imaginarium, which are all about giving kids developmental toys, the, you know, little dolls of endangered animals and all that kind of stuff. And that we have really transformed childhood into something that's sort of meritocratic and developmental. The other effect kids have had is on our religious lives. Many of the people who had sort of self-religions, the New Age religions where they just, it was based on their own experiences, they found that sort of spirituality was very hard to pass down to their kids. So suddenly they go back to the organized religions they thought were too repressive, because those religions are very good at passing down the ethos to the kids through a set of rituals and holidays. And so we get a lot of people who are back in organized faiths, and they're there for the rituals, not necessarily for the God. And that's another influence kid has had. Now, as far as padding our own nests, this is a most noticeable in Silicon Valley, particularly. The first wave of charity was all about giving computers to everybody, which was sort of self-congratulatory. The second wave was giving money to like Harvard and Stanford and Duke, which is like giving money to the next elite, which I didn't particularly think was so great. But I have to say, Bill Gates' foundation, there have been a series of foundations which are now giving more money to the third world and getting more sophisticated, giving money to people who actually need it. What you miss that the Protestant establishment had was a sense of public service. They were an elite, unlike us, who admitted they were an elite, who said, noblesse oblige has to apply to us. And they would commit themselves to public service, especially on a national level, even if it was bad for themselves. In our elite, first of all, we don't admit that we're an elite, so we don't have that same sense of duty. We don't admit often how privileged we are. And so we don't commit to ourselves on a national level. And if we do, somehow the national service always seems to cohere to our personal service. And I don't put myself above anybody in this regard. But in journalism, a lot of us went into journalism because there was an idea, we're going to make the bad guys pay. We're going to do something good for society. But somehow it always seems to go along with having a really big byline and getting some speaking fees and all that kind of stuff. And somehow the merger of our own self-interest and what we say is the public interest, maybe that merger isn't as easy as we think it is. And I suspect if there is an effective rebellion against us, it'll be by people who say, you guys are too easy on yourselves. You can't have the cake and eat it too. You can't have everything.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255. The Bobo connection with the poet laureate of Bobodom, David Brooks, who writes for the Weekly Standard and is always fun and interesting and provocative. Jennifer is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome, Jennifer.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be on the show. I am a media artist who makes a living working for an internet startup here in Boston. My office happens to be in Fort Point Channel, which was once a burgeoning artist community, which is being taken over
Boho
by
Boho Central, yeah.
I wanted to make a point about sort of the postmodernist condition contributing to the boho aesthetic.
Homo boho. Homo bobo, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. And being an artist and being educated in fine arts and psychology and particularly in my experience, seeing a lot of artists of my generation sort of regurgitating a lot of the paradigms over the past 100 years and appropriating images from media, and also sort of this almost over-assertion of individuality, and you gain credibility by how obscure your CD collection is, or how old your vintage dress is, or things like that, and it's troubling. I don't know. It's troubling to me that that today it's not so much how much do you belong to the community, how much do you contribute to society, but how much you can gain for yourself.
Yeah, well, we no longer have creative visions. We have sort of means of self-expression, and that self-expression becomes our status, how good you are at expressing yourself. So it's not enough to have a standard bathroom. You have to be the curator of your own bathroom, have something really creative in there, like a slate shower stall that shows you're at one with the zen-like rhythms of nature. So we've taken the artistic impulse to create something, and we've turned it into a competitive status contest. Who has the best CD collection, as you say, Jennifer, or who has the most arcane intellectual references. And this is something that's probably always existed among intellectuals and artists, but now it becomes replicated in culture. So the stores have to advertise with poems from Keats or from Toni Morrison quotations. So they'll remind all their supposedly independent buyers that, oh, I'm buying from a very refined store that most people wouldn't really get.
Jennifer, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Bobo Connection. Mark is on the line.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Bobo, interesting term. In my day, I'm a mid-30s actual bohemian, also in the Four Point Channel area. We used to call them posers. These people...
Shapers.
They like to walk the walk and talk the talk, and they'll wear their black T-shirts. But at the end of the day, they're just rampant consumer yuppies, as far as most of us down here in the trenches actually producing culture are concerned. These are the type of people that are going to cut down the last babinga tree on the savannah because it's so ethnic.
Do you have one of those die yuppie scum T-shirts on? I'm waiting.
You got the edge, Mark.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's still out there, but I'm waiting for a die Yahoo scum, the opposition to the internet. But I think where I would differ from you, Mark, is that I think that the Bobo life is actually a real life. I think working in a Silicon Valley firm or working in any company is not a sellout necessarily. I think you can live a very honorable life there. I don't think it's impossible if you're rich that you've sold out your soul. I think you'd be rich and very character building. I think working in corporations, you have to deal with other people. You have to anticipate other people's needs.
Mark, fight back.
But the fact of the matter is you can espouse take ecological issues. You know, you can espouse being friendly to the environment, yet still drive, one of the largest vehicles ever created, in these sport utilities. You're talking about being friendly to the third world, and you're wearing sweatshop labor designer clothing. You're eating genetically modified, gourmet foods. Or just, generally speaking, consuming everything in sight. One of the hottest new cuisines is like this Chilean sea bass. It's because they've overfished everything else, so there's nothing left to eat but this ugly fish they call Chilean sea bass.
Yeah. So I would say all that's correct, but I think people do struggle against that. I'm struck by the rule we have in our suburbs, the bigger car, the smaller the woman who drives it. You get these size 6 women in these 40-foot, Suburbans. And so a lot of what you say is true. But, the bohemian life was sometimes an irresponsible life. Sometimes it led to self-nihilism and self-destruction. And one of the great virtues of the bourgeoisie, it takes our system, our capitalist system, and it enshrouds us in a good, basically decent values, industry, modesty.
Steve is the last caller. Are you there, Steve?
Love the show. I was reading this article about a hot new neighborhood in London, and it talked about how it's inhabited by trustafarians.
What's a trustafarian?
A trustafarian is a trust fund baby, got the money from dad and mom, but has dreadlocks and wants to be like a Rastafarian.
Steve, that's great, and it's a great way to end the hour. Bobos, good luck. This is enormously interesting, David Brooks, and it's a wonderful book called Bobos in Paradise. Bobos being bourgeois bohemians, the new upper class, and how they got there. David Brooks, thank you for joining us. And thanks to all the callers and listeners for trumping David Brooks's aces here and there. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Pandesic, a commerce platform for the new economy, powering over 100 e-businesses such as Adidas, HiFi.com, and Oshkosh.